Okay. Everybody got a consciousness? Oh, no, a few more. There's some room at the front here. Okay, let's go. I was thinking that it's really quite a bold thing to do to talk about consciousness, just appreciating my own boldness. It's really so difficult to actually talk about. I do remember an occasion when Sangharakshita was asked the $64,000 question, what is consciousness? And Bhante is usually pretty cooperative, more or less, where questions are concerned. But on this particular occasion, he sort of rounded on the questioner. I think, you know, for rhetorical purposes, saying, why are you asking me? Don't you have a consciousness? And it is odd, isn't it? I mean, I've talked for 2 days, and I'm probably going to succeed in talking for another about consciousness, but I've never really properly defined it, and I assure you I'm not going to, because I've got a certain confidence that you know broadly what I'm talking about. Although what I have tried to emphasize and to help us all to confront is the fact that we can't define consciousness, because consciousness is not objective. It's not something out there. Our mind labels and defines objects. It creates a pattern of words, a language, which all ultimately depends upon sensory information of one kind or another. They're obviously very complex at times, and even very abstracted, but abstracted from an objective realm. Consciousness is what illumines that objective realm. It's not itself objectifiable. And I've been asking you to spend time during these days just trying to sort of examine that. Because I think that if we really face the fact that we cannot know consciousness, we get more conscious. It's as if once we begin to let go of our attempts to define it and grasp it, we really begin to be freely conscious. So yesterday I was talking about the way in which we stop doing that. We don't do that. The way in which we do trap all our experience, or rather we interpret all our experience in terms of the faculty, or by means of the faculty of sanya, which seems to have disappeared. And it's only a word written on a board, but it's not actually there. One of the five skandhas, the faculty of or the category of interpretation, by means of that category, that faculty, we grasp the different elements of our experience and fit them into a grid or a pattern, an intelligible articulated world. We label things, we tell a story about them, we fit them into a pattern of space and time, and thereby we're able to interact with them and do the things that we want to do to get through our day and to survive as organisms, and then of course to do much more complex things as human beings. But the problem we saw yesterday is that faculty of interpretation gets literalized. We mistake the categories that we use in order to make our experience intelligible for reality. It's a bit the equivalent of getting hold of a map and looking at the map and studying the map very closely and never looking at the countryside. or not recognizing that the map is only a sort of approximation, a simplification for the purposes of trying to work out how to get somewhere, of something that is quite different from the map. What came to mind when I was thinking about this in advance was an opera that I went to see in under a railway arch. The orchestra was in a barge in a canal, and the performance took place the other side. It was in Birmingham, of course. Where else would you get such a thing? And it was an intriguing performance, a Monteverdi opera in this extraordinary Victorian railway arch. Quite incongruous, but really delightful. Anyway, I became aware that the man standing next to me, we were standing on the bank of the canal, the man standing next to me was watching the whole opera through his mobile phone. What was actually taking place, it was perfectly easy to see, but he, for some reason, was watching it through his mobile phone. And I thought that's a nice metaphor for what we're doing most of the time. We're sort of watching experience, or we're experiencing through our interpretation of reality. And very often that interpretation can overwhelm even reality itself. You can be so convinced of your interpretation that you miss what's actually happening. And we saw yesterday that this interpretation isn't merely at the sort of functional level of distinguishing the elements of our experience. It goes much deeper than that. Extends to interpreting the whole situation in terms of an independent I, independent self, which has experience, and an independent world which stands separate from the experience that we're having of it. And exists in traditional terms from its own side, independent of the experiential situation. I'm not going to go into that much more. That's a very large question which it would be well worth interrogating further. I'll leave it there for the time being, the external element of it. I'm interested in the internal. We impose upon the experiential situation a framework of an I and an other, the two being separate from each other, existing independently of the moment. So we interpret our consciousness as belonging to I, standing separate from the moment of consciousness, having the moment of consciousness. And what this interpretation does is to limit consciousness. It prevents us from experiencing consciousness in its full richness and possibility. It prevents us also from, the interpretation prevents us from experiencing the information, the data that comes from outside in its full glory and majesty. It limits. It's very useful because that limitation is necessary, otherwise we'd be overwhelmed with the flood of experience. It breaks it up and makes it manageable. But at the same time, it loses something. A bit like looking at the opera through the very inadequate screen of a mobile phone, perhaps with headphones on, really you're sort of narrowing down to a thin trickle, something that's really quite almost overpowering when you face it directly. So we're limiting our experience when we impose upon it and take quite literally the framework of self and other, of I and world, and when we live life through that. But as I was saying yesterday, life is king. Life will not be confined in that sort of way. Consciousness will not be confined in that sort of way. And every now and again, from moment to moment, from time to time, it sort of breaks out. Because consciousness is actually not limited in that sort of way. at every moment it arises fresh, clear, expansive, and immediately we impose upon it this framework. But in each moment it arises again in this fresh, clear, open way. Again, completely beyond our possibility of us making aware to ourselves, it is confined, it's constricted. Just happening again and again and again. Each moment arising fresh and clear, each moment being confined and limited. Put into black and white and 2D, you could say, rather than full colour and 3D. Very inadequate image. But fortunately, yes, it won't be confined. And it breaks out in all sorts of ways. Some of them very painful. At times, our constriction of our experience is felt as great pain, because we constrict experience as being permanent and dependable, and it's not. Constantly escaping our desires, constantly escaping our interpretations. And our own interpretation of ourselves constantly escapes our understanding. We are always something bigger than we know. We try to define ourselves. We try to limit ourselves as the natural function of our habit. But it won't stay. And for a little while, we get a glimpse, maybe a destructive glimpse, a sense that one is being blown apart, that what you thought you were is not what you are. And that's terrifying. Or it can be joyful. Even blissful, well, especially blissful, a sense of something far more expansive, vast, undefinable, and you can let go into that with great joy. But for most of us, the habit of constriction is so strong, going back right the way through our lives, even from a Buddhist point of view, being the basis of our lives. It's a habit that we've carried from other lives in the Buddhist tradition. The habit energy of clinging to self, of clinging to our definitions of reality. That's what we are. We don't have habits, we are a habit. Sangharakshita says, often a bad habit. At least a not very helpful one. One that certainly doesn't allow us to experience life in its full richness and glory, and that keeps us confined to a very narrow idea of ourselves. So what I'm really chiefly trying to get across in these days is that this vast, undefinable, indefinable, uncontrollable consciousness is present all the time. It's what, in a sense, underlies all our experience. But all the time, we're stopping it. All the time, we're putting it back in the cage of samnya. It's not that there's anything wrong with samnya. You need to be able to label things. You need to be able to identify them in order to come to a meditation class or listen to a lecture or whatever. But the problem is that we over-attach to that. Again, like I said with the map, you over-identify the map with the countryside. So we over-identify our construction of reality and mistake it for reality. But all the time, that construction is, as it were, being destroyed. We're constantly having to renew it.
And probably the reason why you're all at a discussion about Buddhism is because you've sensed that. Occasions have come to you when it hasn't worked. Maybe painful occasions when, you know, you wanted it to work, but it doesn't. Or maybe blissful ones when it's simply run away with itself and consciousness has sort of defied your constrictions of it. Whichever it is, it's really brought you here. And it's that we're here to come to terms with and learn to live with the real nature of consciousness, to try to let ourselves live from the basis of consciousness as it is, whilst being able to label and define and do what needs to be done in order to practice the Dhamma and to keep our bodies alive and to interact with each other and so on. But at the same time being aware that all of that is contained within something that is quite indefinable and that is much, much more vast. So our whole Buddhist practice is aimed at bringing us to the point where that experience of consciousness, experience also of the external world, is freed from our narrow definitions of it, our narrow interpretations of it. That's what we're aiming to do. We're aiming to recognize the five skandhas, the five heaps into which all the elements of our experience can be grouped, are simply conditioned processes that have no ultimate validity. We're trying to recognize that this is simply a framework that we impose upon our experience, but that isn't experience itself, is not life itself. In the Buddhist tradition, they're known not just as the five skandhas, the five upadana skandhas, which means the five heaps of grasping, because we cling on to them. We cling on to the representations that senses deliver to us as real. We cling on to our feeling responses, our hedonic responses, as giving us a guide to what is real. We cling on to our interpretations as reality. We cling on to our desires, our emotions, as authentic and genuine and real. And we cling on to consciousness as simply to do with the senses, simply to do with sensing. But yes, our Buddhist practice is directed to undoing the fixity of that interpretive framework. We do that principally through our basic practices. I'll come on to that later. We do that through karmic work. We try to make the whole skanda system more and more elastic, more and more plastic, less and less rigid, less and less firm, so that we become more and more aware of all the elements of our experience as simply conditioned arisings, that we're less and less attached to, that we are able to let come and go without fixing, without clinging. We do that principally through skillful action, through skillful intention, through trying to develop a skillful orientation to life. And that changes the way in which the skanda system emerges, changes the way in which our experience emerges. So it is as if it's more soft, more light, more pliable, more of reality seeps through it. But a point does come when we experience more and more of the reality of things. We experience more and more of consciousness free from this kind of interpretive framework. It's like that all the time, but we just don't let it be like that. But as we practice more and more through all the practices that you'll get at a place like this, we will experience consciousness as free, as open, as indefinable, mysterious, and so on, in the ways that I've been talking of it. So I want to spend a little bit of time trying to connect what I've been talking about in relation to consciousness with other ideas that you may have heard, particularly ones I've talked about in these rambles, because they all connect up. For instance, I've talked a year or so ago about imagination. Imagination as, in a sense, what we really are. Imagination as the faculty for the apprehension of what transcends our narrow definitions. Imagination as what illumines our experience with something beyond the definable. So that, you know, for instance, with the eye of the artist, you look at an ordinary object, and it's no longer an ordinary object. It's illumined. It is full of a higher, a deeper, a further meaning. That is the function of imagination. It invests our experience with a quality that is beyond the merely survival-based awareness. It invests it with something that's beyond I. It invests beauty into our experience. It invests meaning, truth, into our experience. It invests wholeness in our experience, so that you don't experience things in bits and pieces. I don't know whether this is, I think, quite a common experience that one can have of you do this, then you do that, then you do that, and there's all bits and pieces. They don't all add up. You go here, you go there. They don't all sort of cohere. But imagination invests your whole life with a sense of underlying meaning and purpose, which is beyond the merely merely survival, that is to do with deep meanings. So imagination is the faculty, it's the characteristic mode of consciousness once it escapes from clinging to the skandhas. Once consciousness begins to be free from clinging to the skandhas, it emerges, or it functions more and more as imagination. Every element of experience, every moment of consciousness is full of richness, full of meaning. Everything is seen in the light of truth. Everything is seen as illumined, even as beautiful, even if it's, conventionally speaking, ugly. It's invested with great beauty, deep beauty and meaning. So consciousness, when it's able to function free from the definitions, the restrictions of the subject-object clinging, the definitions, the restrictions of clinging to the skandhas, functions as imagination. I don't mean imagination merely in the sense of seeing pictures and images, and although it can be like that, having wonderful visions and wonderful dreams and so forth, although that can be a mode for the for imagination to function through. And it's often a way in which consciousness breaks out of the restrictions we impose upon it. But it can be simply the way in which we see the world around us, so to speak, as it is, but with a depth and meaning that perhaps we most characteristically identify with the artist or the poet, seeing the ordinary as transformed, as illumined. You know, when you look at a great work of art, you see temporarily through the eyes of the artist, and you see through the artist's eyes the ordinary transformed. I always think of Vermeer when I come to talk like that. Those wonderful paintings of Vermeer, the Dutch painter, of quite ordinary scenes, domestic scenes often. You know, somebody pouring from a jug or something like that. And the this ordinary scene, quite ordinary person, ordinary Dutch building, ordinary bricks and so forth, is seen with a clarity and a kind of love that completely transforms it. It's almost photographic in its attention to detail, but what emerges from that is something completely beyond the subject itself. The subject itself is seen as, you could say, it really is, beyond its labellings, its utilitarian labellings. Those moments that you have when you see the familiar in quite a new way, when suddenly something that you've seen every day, you see as if for the first time. This is the characteristic mode of consciousness as it becomes free from the restrictions of clinging to the skandhas, the restriction of the imposed framework of self and other. So this is a very important connection. Imagination is not something that only artists have. Imagination is not something that poets have and nobody else. We all have consciousness. We're all aware. We all know what consciousness is. Once we allow consciousness to be what it is, what it is in its intrinsic nature, you could say, it functions as an imagination, enriching and giving depth, colour, meaning, and it has a corresponding, of course, emotional counterpart, which is a deep sense of engagement and of fascination, of purpose, of meaning. And it's implicit. It's not something you have to do. It's when you allow imagination, when you allow consciousness to emerge from behind the frameworks that we impose upon it, it's naturally like that. Imagination is not something you have to drag out of yourself. It's something you have to discover within yourself. I was looking at a friend's paintings last night, and she'd done some automatic painting, just sprinkling colour on a canvas. And she was saying that when she was doing it, she didn't really know what she was doing. She was just sprinkling the paper, the paint, the colour on the canvas. But something comes from that painting, which is electric and absorbing. I went into her studio and we were eating a meal. I just couldn't stop looking at this painting, which was sort of drawing me into it. So she was saying, you know, people think imagination is something you have to learn, you have to go to a class for. Well, if you do go to a class for imagination, it's to help you to realise that it's a natural function of your own potentiality. It's not something that has to be added to you, something you have to allow to emerge from you. So yes, consciousness, as it begins to free itself from the restrictions that we impose upon it through the skandhas of clinging, the categories of clinging, is naturally functions as imagination. So yes, I talk quite a bit about that, and I've written a paper on it even, and there are some rambles on the theme of imagination. But I've also been talking about following our teacher's hints. I've been talking about what he called at one point a sense of a suprapersonal force, the sense that from the point of view of ordinary consciousness, something seems to work through you that is not really you. It appears from the point of view of your ordinary experience to be other. It seems to be as if, well, it's not necessarily another person, although it can seem like that, but it seems as if you are worked through rather than that you are making something happen. So that consciousness, when it really does get liberated from the restrictions of the self-clinging, the restrictions of the five skandhas as a source of clinging, when it really becomes free from that, it may appear to you as other than you, because it's not you, because it's nothing to do with you or not you. It's outside those mentally constructed definitions. Consciousness is outside all mentally constructed definitions. Consciousness is that within which mentally constructed definitions are experienced, if you see what I mean. Consciousness precedes our structures of it. It even precedes space and time. space and time are, so to speak, within consciousness, rather than consciousness being within space and time. Do you remember my dope experience of driving up the road and realizing that I wasn't driving up the road, but that the road was driving through me? Well, you've all forgotten that. But that sort of sense that your consciousness is just there, and the things that happen to consciousness happen sort of within it, around it. But normally what we do is we think of consciousness as located in space and time. We place it within the framework of space and time. But actually space and time are constructed within consciousness. It's the same with me and you. Me and you does not exist prior to consciousness. I'm sure you do too. You probably do. We add I and you to consciousness. We use it to structure our experience. But consciousness itself is innocent of you and me and I and other. It's not that it's beyond me in the sense of being something else, but at the same time it's not me. It's simply awareness. Without anybody observing or anybody being aware, and in a sense, nothing that's observed. There is simply awareness within which everything takes place. So you may, when you get quite strong experiences of consciousness as it really is, you may even experience it as sort of other, as something sort of operating on you or in you or through you, rather than as yours. Because we think, I have consciousness. You know, like I've got this thing. I've got a watch. We think I've got consciousness like that. That's the form of the language we use. My consciousness. I have awareness. But it's not like that. The I happens within consciousness, not consciousness within the I. So from the point of view, because for a long time we're still function within the framework of the skandhas, from the point of view of clinging to self, consciousness, when it begins to emerge, may be experienced as other than me. That's okay. That's fine. That's normal. You know, don't worry if you're a Buddhist and you think you're experiencing God. You are. But God is consciousness, if you see what I mean. Well, that's the way it meant that, you know. Anyway, I won't go there. But I don't mind God. He's all right. Just as long as you don't sort of get too literal about him or her or it or whatever. But that's the way one sort of it may experience it, as something other than one, functioning through one, because it's beyond the whole framework of I. The other thing Bhante talks about, a suprapersonal force, suprapersonal in the sense that consciousness, when it's really experienced as it is beyond the personal. Personhood doesn't exist in consciousness. It's bigger than consciousness. It's not subpersonal, it's not impersonal, it's suprapersonal, if you see what I mean. It's more than personal. Because if you think of it as impersonal, that seems like it's beneath the personal, less than personal. It's sort of abstract and dead. But it's something more than that. So it's suprapersonal, but he talks about it as a force. I think this is very, very important. When we use the word consciousness, awareness, because the word is etymologically to do with cognition, to do with knowing, comes under the category, so to speak, of the knowing side of things rather than the emotional side of things. And it seems that what you're talking about is a great big searchlight that you're shining on the world around you, that's sort of neutral and rather cold, maybe. Maybe you don't think like this, but that's what the word, I think, tends to connote. And also sort of static. Of course, even to think in terms of static and non-static is itself something that is kind of within consciousness rather than consciousness itself. But it's nearer to the truth of it to think of consciousness as dynamic, as a force, that's something that has a sort of a pressure and a momentum. I mean, it's really the pressure of consciousness, damn it, that's brought you through the door. It's sort of the urge to find some sort of answer to, some way of working out something that you've experienced quite naturally, that isn't sort of Buddhist, it's just part of life. Well, I'm arguing that that is the pressure that consciousness imposes upon you, because it cannot be, it will not be restricted. So consciousness is dynamic. It unfolds. It's a force that seeks to unfold. And in a sense, what we do, what our ordinary life is about, is keeping it in. It's like a cat that's always trying to get out the door and you're always trying to move it in. I don't know why cats are a completely inappropriate image. But it's a bit like something that's sort of a spirit, a force that just cannot be put inside a space, that drifts through the gaps and forces itself out, that blows apart whatever structures and restrictions we impose upon it, that seeks to be itself, if you like. And that is dynamic. Our ordinary life is often a rearguard action against the pressures of consciousness. Constantly defining and redefining ourselves. You know, those moments when you have a glimpse through, you know, I mentioned yesterday, particularly when somebody close to you dies, you get a glimpse of the complete ridiculousness of our usual way of thinking about ourselves. Death just says no. And you can see how in the days following the death, your mind is fighting to get it back together again. Sometimes you never succeed. Sometimes that is really problematic and can even lead to severe problems. But you can see the way in which your mind seeks to contain the uncontainable. That's what, in a sense, we are as an ego identity, as a self-identity. We are in the desperate attempt to hold it together, more or less successful. The struggle every day to hold it together. But consciousness, dynamic, and refuses to be contained. And of course, there's a whole fascinating exploration in Buddhist tradition of what happens after death, as consciousness just liberates itself, just becomes completely free. And then our habit energy, the habit energy of our past clinging to identity, reasserts itself until we long for a body. You know, whether you accept that structure or not, you can at least take that as a myth for what we're doing moment by moment. So consciousness unfolds. And when we allow it to unfold, it unfolds in a regular way, as it were. It unfolds in accordance with, well, you could say, a law. It unfolds systematically or regularly. The Buddha Dhamma teaches that everything arises, or whatever arises in dependence on conditions. And even our experience of consciousness is unfolding, arises in dependence on conditions. But the conditioned processes it arises in dependence upon are quite different to those that we usually experience. The characteristic of this kind of conditionality, this kind of conditioned law, is that it transcends itself. One stage of consciousness, when it's allowed, flows on to a greater one. And that greater one flows on to a greater one. It is as if, a bit like having a gas that's liquefied and you let it out of a nozzle and it sort of spreads, it expands.
don't know whether that metaphor works. So terrible using metaphors when you're relating to something like this, which is where metaphors happen, if you see what I mean. You know, Kant said, didn't he, that there are certain questions that are too big for our minds. I always like that in Kant, that the antimonies of reason. But in a way, the discussion of consciousness is too big for our little minds, because it is that within which that little mind unfolds, so to speak. So that's a restriction of our experience. So consciousness unfolds. When we begin to let the brakes off, it unfolds, it spills over from more to greater to greatest and so on. And you could say, even in a sense, unendingly. It, of course, at a certain point transcends even that category of transcendence. But it naturally, spontaneously expands when we let it, when we take the brakes off, when we take the constriction off, it naturally unfolds. So, yes, it's a suprapersonal force. It's not me, it's not mine, it's not myself. It's simply awareness, and it naturally acts within me all the time, through me, in the narrow sense that we usually think of me. But me is usually trying to stop it, hold it under control. But there's another, where so many characteristics of consciousness as it really begins to unfold, and this merits really much more exposition, but I want to touch on something else before I conclude. So I'll just take one more important characteristic, or some important word that we use, which is bodhicitta. Those of you who are familiar with Buddhism will know this word, bodhicitta. Citta means mind, or consciousness, actually. Bodhi means awakening. It's connected etymologically with Buddha. The Buddha is one who has bodhi. So one who has woken up from the dream of the skandhas, the false identification with the skandhas. So bodhicitta is usually translated as something enlightening mind, the mind that is charged towards awakening. That's a bit like the suprapersonal force when you put it like that. But it's particularly understood in terms of its lack of selfishness. Bodhicitta is the transcendence of self-orientation. Once consciousness is experienced as it really is, it's no longer concerned merely with I. It's no longer even identified with I. In the experience of consciousness as it is, of course, insofar as your physical being will be an object of consciousness, you'll be conscious of it, in a sense, as I. But as the Buddha says, merely as a conventional term. Do you see what I mean? It's just a way of talking. It's as if, but it's not reality. You know it's not reality. And you're therefore open to, or rather consciousness, is open to the entire field of experience. And it's not identified narrowly with this element of the field of consciousness. That's the bizarre thing. We're all sitting here conscious with this glorious consciousness, but we each of us, well, I can't speak for you lot anyway, but I can speak for me, we're identified with this bit of it. And I'm only interested in you thinking what a wonderful talk I'm giving. Or whatever, joking apart. You know what I mean? I'm sort of primarily concerned with my bit of it. But actually, you're all in my experience. You're all part of consciousness as it's emerging. And bodhicitta is consciousness emerging, an emphasis on consciousness as it emerges, as transcending a narrow self-identification, as being selfless, because self makes less and less sense. You recognise that it's just a way of talking about a particular
sort of aspect of the field of experience. So you're identified, you could say, with the entire field of experience.
That will have very direct practical consequences. It's very important for us in the West because we're so obsessed with our own psychology and our own inner workings and so forth, and very little with, not very little, of course not, but we tend in Buddhism even to be radically sort of self-obsessed. We're more self-obsessed than anybody else. But actually the whole Buddhist effort is to get out of that, to get free from that, so that one's really just concerned with the entire field of consciousness. You'll learn more about this if you come on Sunday. Is it Sunday, the Ambedkar Day? Yeah, and you'll hear Maitreya Nagarjuna talking about Dr. Ambedkar, who was a modern Buddhist in India, who taught Buddhism as a means of social liberation, social development. So that is a representative of this spirit, what we're aiming at is the experience of consciousness liberated from self-obsession, from selfishness. What a relief. I get sick of myself. Unfortunately, not sick enough to do anything about it, but you get sick of it. I always remember about my dear old mother, who lived to the age of 92, bedridden for the last 6 years of her life, very vigorous. She's a New Zealander, so that explains everything. And I remember her lying there saying, "I'm sick of being me." And I knew exactly what she meant. So, you know, I said, "Well, don't worry. Just wait a bit and you'll get some relief." But, you know, bodhicitta is the experience of consciousness as it really is, which is free from this self-obsession, which is so painful, so compelling, and yet so painful. And creates so much trouble in the world, because it's from that all our conflict and economic crises and oppressions of one person over another, domination of one over another, wars, etc., all emerge. I've just touched on a few ways in which we can connect what I've been talking about in terms of consciousness with what has been talked about elsewhere on other occasions. Consciousness and its characteristic mode of operation is imagination. When consciousness really begins to be free, it is imagination. When consciousness really begins to transcend our self-clinging, it's experienced as suprapersonal and as a force, as dynamic, as unfolding naturally through our experience. Within our experience, even at times, so to speak, guiding us. There can even be an experience that what you're doing, you're not doing. It's just happening through you. I mean that and of course there's a negative sense of that, where you don't take responsibility. I mean as something that, in a way, you completely willingly and responsibly allow to happen through you. Artistic creation is a well-known example of that, where somebody is creating, but their feeling is that they're not doing it. But altruistic activity can be of that kind, where you are in a situation of crisis, you just do, without any question, without any thought, you just act, and in a way you don't even feel that you did it. People praise you afterwards, and you're sort of surprised, and even a bit embarrassed. Because it's something that happened, not something you did. And of course that connects very strongly with bodhicitta. I could go on. There are many, many different ways one could talk about it. One can connect consciousness with love, for instance. I was mentioning to somebody that wonderful film by Kieslowski, Three Colours, have you seen that? Blue, the first one, I strongly recommend it. And it ends with a musical setting of St. Paul's. If you speak with the voice of angels and have not love, then, etc., you're nothing. Very, very beautiful passage and beautifully realized.
consciousness, when it's really consciousness, is love. It dissolves barriers. It unites. It cherishes. It is at one. Oh, I came across something by Thomas Traherne, great English 17th century mystic and poet. Some of you will be familiar with it from different contexts, but in centuries of meditation, he says, "You'll never enjoy the world aright until the sea itself floweth in your veins, and you are clothed by the heavens and crowned with the stars." So no separation. Everything's completely flowing through you. You are not separate from things. The sea itself floweth in your veins. When you look at the sky, you don't see something outside you. You're identified with consciousness, which includes the stars, as well as, you know, your more immediate sensations. So one could go on. One could talk more and more about what this consciousness that is here right now, in every one of us, right this moment, in our immediate experience, consciousness is a sine qua non. We couldn't be experiencing if there wasn't consciousness. And right now, consciousness is all that I've been talking about it, all that I've been saying of it. It is imagination. It is a suprapersonal force. It is bodhicitta. It is love. But we impose this structure, this restriction of the skandhas, which we cling to. We misunderstand, and that prevents us from allowing consciousness to unfold as it really is. I've got 10 minutes to tell you what to do about it. Keep coming to the LBC. That's the answer. Keep taking the medicine. Basically, everything in our Dhamma practice is aimed at liberating consciousness. Or not liberating consciousness, at realizing consciousness as it really is. It's not that we're trying to do something, we're trying to allow something to happen. And we're trying through our practice, for instance, we're integrating ourselves, that is, becoming more fully aware of all the processes that go on within us, so that we understand them properly. We recognize that they're conditioned processes. They're not ultimately real. That's the point of integration, that you make fully conscious what's going on within you, you know, that the sensations that arise, you recognize that they're sensations. They're not reality itself. The feelings that you have, they're not reality itself. They're just conditioned processes that arise in dependence upon certain factors. You recognize that your samnya, your interpretation of reality, useful as it is not reality. You recognize that your desires, they may be aligned with consciousness itself. When that suprapersonal force works through you, your desires are simply the expression of that. But more often than not, one's desires are connected with the preservation of self-identity. And you realize that that's simply a conditioned process. And that our narrow understanding of consciousness as merely to do with sensing is just a conditioned process. So you integrate those processes as processes. That's what you're aiming to do, so that you're aware of them rather than them confining your awareness. You develop positive intention, positive emotion. You develop metta, for instance, because to begin with, you're developing metta from this self towards other selves, but metta is in the end independent of or greater than self. Now, for instance, when you do the metta bhavana, the Maitri bhavana, in the fifth stage of the metta bhavana, it's not really to do with you anymore. There's just love flowing through you. If you really experience it, it's not me towards you. It's good. It's better than anything else. But the natural tendency of that sort of practice is to transcend itself, so that you just experience metta, spiritual receptivity, just sitting. You're learning to allow consciousness to be in its natural state, consciousness to be what it really is. You're trying to relax into consciousness. Quite difficult. You're just trying to not control, not judge, not fix, not will. You just allow consciousness to expand. Not allow it to expand, because it's going to do it whether you like it or not. But you let it happen. Well, what we call practices connected with spiritual death, which is to do with recognizing that this is all a construction, that it has no ultimate validity. So you do practices, reflections, you reflect on the Dhamma, you listen to expositions like this, so that you recognize the nature of this constriction, this structure that you impose upon your experience, and you recognize that it is simply a construction. It's an as-if. It is not reality. So you see through it so that you can set it aside, or you can see what's bigger than it. And you practice what we call spiritual rebirth, which is not being reborn in a future life. That just happens anyway, according to Buddhism. It's connecting with what goes beyond that self-clinging. It's connecting with, you could say, consciousness, particularly in the form of the Buddha. Because the Buddha, for us, is one who has allowed consciousness fully to expand, who has let consciousness be completely free of the restrictions that we impose upon it. So we connect with the Buddha, because through the Buddha we can more easily connect with consciousness as well, you could say, if I said who we really are, that's very problematic, but let's put it like that. Let's be problematic for a change. Because, of course, we aren't really anything. Of course, we're not really nothing, but anyway, you get what I mean. So we deliberately cultivate a connection with the Buddha and other, whatever else for us represents this transcendence of self-clinging, so that we're kind of opening ourselves up to it. Because there are moments when this just happens. And by and large, they're not Buddhist moments, if you know what I mean. This is the untidy thing about it all, that it would be so convenient if insight into the nature of things happened when you were doing Buddhist things. It tends not to happen like that. It happens when you're having a pee or something like that, or eating something, or you stub your toe, or when you're just walking along, or when something really goes badly wrong. All the work that you do makes that more likely to happen, and the more you've been working, when it does happen, the more likely you are to embrace it. I remember, going back to my LSD experiences, I seem to have been getting into those this time, but I remember taking LSD as a young man, 20, 21. And, I think I did have experiences of raw consciousness free from those constructions. But you just scared the life out of me. I'm completely unable to connect with it and just desperately trying to think my way out of it. I remember a phrase came through my mind, cancer the mind crab crawls through time. Those things you write down when you're on... Anyway, sorry, you're not all old hippies, are you? I'm completely unable to connect with it. And it does happen. It happens to all of us because consciousness will not be defined. Consciousness will not fit into the narrow constructions that we impose upon ourselves and our lives. It just will not fit. And it, at odd moments, in the middle of the night seems to be a big one for me, it just emerges. And you just think, what on earth is that all about? Or you can have those moments where you're in the middle of a blazing row. I do have those. I rather like blazing rows. And you're sort of in the middle of the blazing row and you're thinking, what's this all about? What am I going on about? It just seems completely irrelevant. And just something emerges that completely explodes your narrow constriction of life. The more you've been practicing,
the Dhamma in the ways that I've briefly described, the more likely that is to happen, and the more likely it is that you will welcome it, you will rejoice in it, you'll embrace it, and eventually you'll live from it. And you'll not only live from it, but you'll live from it to help others to realise their own real freedom. And what's wonderful about this perspective is that it demonstrates that for every one of us, there's something about us right now that cannot ultimately be confined. Right now, whatever the restrictions of your circumstance and your situation, there's something about you that doesn't fit. It's consciousness itself. Yes, we quickly narrow it down. We quickly confine it, define it. But consciousness itself refuses those definitions. And I hope that, if nothing else, during these rambles, I've sort of illustrated that and at least given some people, if they didn't have it already, a bit more confidence and courage to unleash this force within them, this this natural part of experience, which is the fundamental of experience, that within which experience takes place, which always is greater than experience. And I hope that at the same time you recognise there's a lot of work to do to get that really incorporated. You can have glimpses, and that's very good. You can have quite big glimpses, but to really settle upon it and to live from it is a lot of work. A lot of work, and very systematic and thorough work, involving your whole life. Of course, the work is aided, so to speak, by the pressure coming from consciousness itself. You're working with the force of consciousness itself, but because of the habit energy that you brought into this life, the habit energy of self-clinging, there's a lot of work to finally get it free, but it can be done. And you can have a glimpse that it can be done simply by recognizing that consciousness cannot be defined. So I'll leave it there and hope that I've communicated something of value to you.